In 1993, Terry interviewed Jimmy Carter on the publication of his memoir, Turning Point. They discussed his first political campaign when he ran for the Georgia State Senate. Carter decided to enter politics shortly after the Supreme Court issued its one-man, one-vote ruling in the case Baker versus Carr. This was in 1962.
Well, I had come home from the Navy, having been 11 years a full-time naval officer, a submarine officer, started a small business, and had never run for elective office. I was a chairman of the Sumter County School Board in the heat of the integration years. I was concerned about the closing down or the subversion of our public school system. And I was disgusted in a way with the slow pace of the civil rights changes in the South. And then along came the bright halcyon days of the one man, one vote ruling, where the Democratic white rural primary was going to be stricken down. I thought it was a new day in Georgia and the United States, where the democracy would prevail and honesty would be there and equality would be ensured. And so I decided I would run for the state Senate. And the only request I would make and did finally make was to be on the Education Committee. And I entered this little community over in the western part of Georgia, Georgetown, Georgia. And I found shocking fraud, corruption, stuffing ballot boxes, abuse of citizens, that was incredible to me.
Well, you say you found blatant voting abuse. What's the worst example of voting abuse that you faced during that first campaign of yours?
Well, I was ahead in the election going into this little tiny county on the Chattahoochee River, just across the river from Alabama. There was a political boss in the county named Joe Hurst. He was chairman of the only political organization, the Democratic Committee. He was a state legislator. He was the only state legislator that was authorized by special law to be a full-time state employee. His wife was a welfare director. Georgetown was the only post office in the United States, for instance, where all the welfare checks came to the same post office box. And he and his wife would personally deliver the welfare checks to families that they decided should be on welfare. One of the prerequisites for getting welfare payment was to vote the way Joe Hurst told them. There's no way to ensure that someone votes the way you tell them unless you know how they vote. So a secret ballot was totally out of the question. Everyone who voted in my election in that little town voted on an open table in front of Joe Hurst and one of his henchmen, whose name was Doc Hammond. Joe Hurst watched them vote. They put their ballots in a large whiskey box, a pasteboard box with a 5-inch hole in the top, and quite often I watched Joe Hurst reach in, pull out the ballots, examine them, even change them when he wanted to, and put in ballots of his own. It was literally incredible. And he was so powerful that he was impervious to criticism. He didn't even care if I saw him cheating. He had control of a district attorney. He had control of a trial judge. He had been indicted 8 times on felony charges, convicted 4 times, but never served a day in jail or paid $1 in fine. He was so powerful, it was unbelievable to me. And so I had that to challenge, and many of the people in that little county were intimidated by Hurst. The crucial base of his operation was the county unit system. One vote in Georgetown was equal to 99 votes in Atlanta. And this was all legal. It was perfectly legal until the one-man, one-vote ruling came down.
Well, you say that he was so impervious to criticism, he was so arrogant that even when you caught him in the act of fraud, what he said to you was, well, this is such a simple election that we've decided voting booths aren't necessary.
He said, you know, people don't mind if I know how they vote. Why should we have voting booths? There were some voting booths in the courthouse chamber, which he didn't bother to use. He had squeezed people in a little tiny room so that the only place they could vote was on a counter in the ordinary's office, the probate judge's office, so he and his assistant could watch each vote counted, a cast.
Well, how do you challenge electoral fraud when the people who you have to take the challenge to are aligned with the same people responsible for the fraud?
Well, even with his oppression or inducement of people to vote against me, I would still have won had he not stuffed the ballot box. There were only 333 people who went to the polls that day. There were 421 ballots in the box when they were counted. 118 of them voted alphabetically down to the last letters in their name, a number of whom were dead and or in prison or living in states and way off, and they hadn't voted at all. He was the ultimate appeal in the county, in the entire process, in that role that he played. This was in accordance with the Georgia law. The final decision in any election held in Quitman County, which was Georgetown, was a county seat, was made by the Democratic primary committee that was controlled by Joe Hurst. I finally did win that election, but even then, I had to go to the Georgia Senate, and under the Georgia law, the Georgia Senate has a final determination about who will be seated in that body.
How did you win? How did you get your fair count?
Well, I think a lot of publicity had accrued. I couldn't get any publicity at all at first. The local newspapers, even in Columbus, Georgia, which is a fairly good-sized town, were kind of in bed with Joe Hurst, or they had seen him do this so long that they thought it was maybe acceptable or wasn't really a newsworthy item, until there was one very heroic reporter from the Atlanta Journal named John Pennington, who came down quite skeptical at first about my allegations. And he, on his own initiative, went into Quitman County, got some old records, and interviewed Joe Hurst and all the other people, and found out that my accusations were true. And in a few days, this story about my election was a top headline news on the front page of the Atlanta newspapers. And so I didn't have to operate in a vacuum anymore. And there was no doubt in anybody's mind who read the newspaper or who listened to the news that this was a crime of the first degree in the case of elections.
You know what I found really interesting? Your opponent in that very first election of yours back in 1962, your opponent Homer Moore, ended up supporting you in your presidential campaign. What happened in those intervening years that he became an ally?
He was a good guy. And I don't think he had any knowledge about the ballot box stuffing. This was done in one of the seven counties by this man, Joe Hurst. Homer Moore was a warehouseman like I was. He was in the peanut business, the fertilizer business, and I had known him for a good while. And so he and I stayed at fairly good terms, even during all the court tests, and both of us wanted to win, of course. Later, after I had been governor, and when I ran for president, Homer Moore and his campaign chairman, whose name was Sam Singer, both went to foreign states, including New Hampshire, and campaigned for me. So, you know, we wound up to be and continued to be friends. And so Joe Hurst eventually went to prison for vote fraud and also for dealing in illegal liquor. And when I finally got to the Georgia Senate, one of the things that I wanted to do, although I'm not a lawyer, was to revise the Georgia election code to correct some of the patent mistakes that had been deliberately maintained over decades or generations in Georgia to permit this kind of thing. And as we were debating the new election code, one of the interesting amendments that was put forward by a state senator from the town of Enigma, Georgia, an interesting name, was that no one in Georgia could vote in a primary election or a general election who had been dead more than 3 years.
Interesting cutoff point.
Yeah, but there was a very interesting debate about it, too. People maintained that even though, say, a husband died, there was a certain period of time after his death when the wife and children could accurately cast his vote the way he would have voted if he had lived. And so how long after somebody's death do circumstances change so much that you can't really predict how he would have voted?
President Jimmy Carter from a 1993 interview. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring a 1993 interview with Jimmy Carter.
What was the most disorienting part of your first day and night in the White House?
I had pretty well gotten my cabinet firmed up quite early after the election. And what do you do the next day to deal with a multitude of issues? I had a very fine agenda. I couldn't get much support originally from the Congress, although finally my batting average was about the same as Lyndon Johnson's or John Kennedy. You know, what do you do when you get in the Oval Office? I hardly knew where it was. I had visited it once before. President Ford invited me in to see the Oval Office after I had won the election. I have to say, though, as a bottom line, that I was quite confident of myself. I wasn't plagued with trepidation that I was inadequate for the job. That they may be presumptuous, but anybody who decides I want to be president of this great country has to be somewhat presumptuous. So I wasn't plagued with an inferiority complex. I felt that no matter what came up, that I could handle it as well as anyone.
What about during the hostage crisis? Was there ever a point where you wished that you weren't president, where you wished that you didn't have this terrible burden on your shoulders?
Well, about 2 o'clock in the morning in April when we tried the rescue operation and we couldn't succeed, that was perhaps the high point of despair in my presidency. And I knew that I had to get up early the next morning, about 6 o'clock, and prepare to go on all the morning talk shows and explain to the American people that the rescue operation had failed. That was a very dismal point. Also, we knew that an accident had occurred and that one of the helicopters had flown into an airplane and that 8 people had died. And I had to notify those families during the night that their loved ones had perished in a secret operation. There's no way that anything else that happened during the 4 years could equal that as a time of discouragement and despair.
Yeah. You told us a little bit about what your inauguration day was like. Let's skip ahead to the inauguration of your successor, Ronald Reagan. What were you feeling that day as you realized that the hostages were going to be released on his watch, not on yours?
Well, I didn't realize that. I had not been to bed for 3 days and had negotiated in the most meticulous detail the release of the hostages. Everything was all agreed, and the hostages were in the airplane ready to take off at 10 o'clock that morning, Washington time. So we were just waiting to get word that they had cleared Iranian airspace. And when I went to the reviewing stand, when I relinquished the presidency to Reagan and he made his inaugural speech, before I left the reviewing stand, I was informed that the plane had indeed taken off and the hostages were all safe and free. I have to say that I didn't even think about the fact that it happened a few minutes after midnight, after noontime. I just knew that they were free, and that was one of the most glorious and happy moments of my entire life.
Even though it wasn't on your watch?
Well, to me, I didn't even think about it, but obviously that became the major story among the news media, that it happened about 20 minutes after I was no longer president. To me, that was insignificant, but it has still prevailed. Even your question indicates that it was a historically important fact that it happened a few minutes after I left the White House as a president rather than while I was still in office.
My guest is former President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, before we go any further, I'm going to ask you for a little lesson in etiquette. Do I call you President Carter, Mr. President, our former President Jimmy Carter? What is the appropriate etiquette when you're talking to a former President of the United States?
You know, one of the nice things about our country is you can call me anything you want to. Jimmy suits me okay. There is a custom in our nation that if you are have been a governor or an ambassador or a judge or president, then you can still retain the title. So if you want to call me president, you can. If you want to call me Jimmy, that's fine. You know, when I go through Georgia, small towns, and somebody is an old friend of mine, I know it immediately when they say, "Hi, Governor." They call this. that's whatever the most intimate relationship is. And the little kids around Plains, when I ride a bicycle or jog by, if they are very devout, or if their families go to church every Sunday, they call me Brother Jimmy. Hello, Brother Jimmy. And a lot of them just call me, "Hello, Jimmy Carter." But it doesn't matter to me. I never was much dependent on the pomp and ceremony of the White House, even when I was there. And so Jimmy suits me fine.
Jimmy Carter, from a 1993 interview with Terry. We'll continue our celebration of Jimmy Carter's 75th birthday today in the second half of our program. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jimmy Carter turns 75 today. Over the years, we've had the privilege of having the former president as a guest a number of times on Fresh Air. In 1995, Terry spoke with him on the publication of his book of poetry, Always a Reckoning.
What do you think the assumptions are that people make when they hear a former president is also a poet?
Well, I think it's been a rare thing in history to have a president who was a published poet. I imagine a lot of folks that have been in the White House have written a poem or two.
And hid them.
And hid them, yes, or shared them with maybe a wife on Mother's Day or something of that kind. But I think the general reaction would be, well, they'll be extremely amateurish, or they'll just be frivolous. Or
inspirational, or calls to patriotism.
I think so. But I think in this particular book, I put together about 45 poems and tried to make them as diverse as I could in their character.
Well, let's have you read a poem, if you don't mind. And I'd like you to read a poem called Of My Father's Cancer and His Dreams. And you're welcome to introduce this if you'd like, or to just begin the poem. But I think it would be nice for you to tell us first when you wrote it.
I've written most of these poems in the last 5 years, and what I've done ordinarily is revise each poem maybe a dozen or 20 times, trying to simplify them, make sure we had the right word and that the words were juxtaposed properly and that the lines either rhymed or didn't rhyme. In this particular poem, there are kind of slant rhymes. They're not direct rhymes, but I think the listener can probably detect them. This one is a poem about my father's last days. I was a submarine officer working under Admiral Rickover, developing the second nuclear submarine in history. And my father, I learned, was dying. And I went home to be with him. And I've tried to put myself in the position of someone who is in his or her last days on a deathbed and how they might react to the world around them. The name of this poem is Of My Father's Cancer and His Dreams. With those who love him near his bed, seldom speaking anymore, he lies too weak to raise his head but dreams from time to time. In one, he says, he sees his wife, so proud in her white uniform, with other nurses trooping by, their girlish voices aimed to charm the young men lounging there. Then her eyes met his, and hold, a country courtship has begun. They've been together 30 years. Now she watches over him as she tries to hide her tears. All his children are at home, but wonder what they ought to say or do, either when he is awake or when he seems to fade away. They can't always be on guard, and sometimes if his mind is clear, he can grasp a whispered phrase never meant for him to hear. He just seems weaker all the time. I don't know what else to cook. He can't keep down anything. He hears a knocking on the door, voices of his friends who bring a special cake or fresh-killed quail. They mumble out some words of love, try to learn how he might feel, and then go back to spread the word. They say he may have faded some. He'll soon give in to the rising pain and crave the needle that will numb his knowledge of a passing world and bring the consummating sleep he knows will come.
Have you read that poem? Did you read that poem to your family before publishing it?
All my family are dead. I read it to Rosalind.
Yeah, I was thinking of Rosalind.
But
yeah.
My father and my mother and both my sisters and my brother have all died with cancer. And so I don't have anyone to read it to except my wife, who's a very good editor and who is familiar with all these poems.
When you're president of the United States, you're the most important person in the country, and you have the most power and so on. And then when, fairly late in life, you start writing poetry more seriously than you ever wrote it before.
Yes.
I mean, you're getting started, pretty late with that and everything. There might be this feeling, well, how could I possibly be any good? And
as former president, I'm only allowed to do things that I can really excel in. Did you ever go through a crisis about that and think, like, if you wrote poems, they'd better be the best poems, otherwise you wouldn't be able to measure up to your own standards?
Well, I did, and I have to say that I approached it fairly tentatively. I didn't just all of a sudden decide I'm going to write a book of poems.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a few poems, and then I submitted them to magazines and to quarterlies around the country.
Anonymously?
Well, I would put Jay Carter on them, and they would ask the publishers not to reveal the fact that they came from a former president, not to mention that at all. And then there were, you know, very helpful critical reviews, most of them, by the way, favorable, I have to say. And so I increased in my confidence with experience. And finally, I decided to take about 45 of my poems and to put them together in this book.
Well, did you get rejection slips from anybody?
Yes, a few.
Now, did that hurt a lot?
Not really, because I didn't expect very much at the beginning. I expected to be rejected, and when I did get an acceptance, it was a very pleasant surprise. I submitted a few poems to some of the more prominent magazines, and the first time I sent a few poems to my present publisher, he said that he didn't think that a poetry book was appropriate for me. And I took one of the poems out of the New Yorker magazine that I could not comprehend at all, and I sent it to him, Peter Osnos. He says he has it on his wall in his office, but it's a totally incomprehensible, ugly collection of words that has no meaning to me, no rhythm, no rhyme. The words are not even good, but it was published in the New Yorker magazine, and I don't understand that kind of poetry. So, you know, I went through a laborious process of finally saying, okay, I'm going to publish the poems that I like. I'm going to let them be truly expressive of my inner feelings, and if people like them, fine. If they don't, okay. So far, the reviews have been quite favorable.
There's another poem I'm going to ask you to read called Difficult Times.
Okay. It's a very brief poem. That's the title of Difficult Times. I try to understand. I've seen you draw away and show the pain. It's hard to know what I can say to turn things right again, to have the coolness melt, to share once more the warmth we've felt.
Was that a poem to Rosalind?
Yes, when we were having some difficult times. And that first version of the poem is not this one. I rewrote it several times to simplify it and to abbreviate it. But I think we all go through those things, and there's a reaching out to someone else that can be expressed in poetry that can be expressed, at least by me, in prose or verbally.
So did you give her the poem after you wrote it?
Yes.
Did that help
We got along
warm
right.
things up?
Well, we're still...
We're still together.
we're now approaching our 49th wedding anniversary, so yes, it did.
Now, this is an example of a poem that I would expect you might have reservations publishing if you were in the White House. Because then I could see all the press coming and saying, well, what was the dispute about and how long did it last? You know what I mean? And it just kind of being measured and interpreted in a way that was... Both very literal and very, much like the character issue as opposed to a poem.
I don't think I could have possibly published these poems, you know, while I was still in the White House or even tried to.
And tell me why.
Well, they're too self revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And they open up questions that I don't think ought to be explored in a White House press conference. I don't mind exploring them with you because I can kind of be evasive if I want to.
And that's no comment on my skills as an interviewer, right?
That's right. You're a very good interviewer. But I, obviously this is something that couldn't be done. If I couldn't have had time to write them when I was in the White House. These poems took a lot of work. 5 years off and on of hours and hours and hours of struggling with a line or with a word or with a concept. And they're the product of a great deal of self-examination.
Jimmy Carter. Terry spoke with him in 1995. Coming up, Jimmy Carter reflects on his spiritual life. This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter is a born-again Christian, and his religious beliefs have always been an important part of his life. In 1996, Terry spoke with him on the publication of his book, Living Faith, in which he wrote about his faith and how it sustained him while he was president.
How did you approach your prayer life in the White House? You say in your book that other presidents have brought in Billy Graham to organize worship for them, but you didn't want to do that in the White House. You thought it violated your sense of separation of church and state. So what did you do?
Well, I worshiped as I would if I had not been in public life at all. I went to Sunday services at the First Baptist Church in Washington, which was the nearest Baptist church to the White House. Most of the weekends we tried to go to Camp David. We had a chaplain from a nearby army base come and preach a sermon. We sang hymns together. And as far as my personal prayer life was concerned, I would say it was much more frequent and maybe on the average more heartfelt than ever, any other time in my life, because I felt that the decisions I made were affecting the lives of hundreds of millions of people. I never prayed for popularity. I never prayed to be reelected, things of that kind. I prayed that I could keep my nation at peace. I prayed that I could extend the advantages of peace to other people, say, between Egypt and Israel at Camp David. When the hostage crisis came along, the prayer that I made was that all the hostages would come back home safe and free, that I would not betray the principles of my nation or do anything to embarrass it. And I think in all those cases, my prayers were answered. I think God always answers our prayers. Quite often, God's answer is no. We don't get what we ask for. And then the obligation, if we have faith, is to find out within ourselves why. Are we asking for selfish things? Are we asking for things that are unjustified? Are we asking for things that ought to be granted in the future? Should we change the priorities in our lives? Are our prayers in accordance with God's will? Those are the kind of things that I've learned over a long lifetime, as you know. And those are the things I try to describe in Living Faith.
What was your sense of prayer when you were a child, and how has your sense of prayer changed as an adult?
Well, when I was a child, say when I reached the age of 10 or teenage life, I had some very serious doubts about what I heard in church, what I heard in Sunday school, what I heard my own father teaching. But I wouldn't express my doubts to anybody. And I thought I was very sinful not to have absolute and total faith. Now my faith is stronger. I can see the various aspects of a deep Christian faith. I realize that as I was at the age of 15, I'm still searching, I'm still trying to learn, I'm still trying to stretch my heart, stretch my mind. I learned two or three times in my life that my faith could sustain total doubt in God. I rejected God a few times. I felt that God had betrayed me, that I could not depend on my faith at all. And I had to go through a very difficult and unpleasant healing process. I've learned over a period of a long lifetime, 50 years of marriage with Rosalind, how sadly mistaken I was in dealing with her. When we first got married, I was an arrogant young Naval Academy graduate. Rosalind was a very shy, timid, younger person from Plains, Georgia. I totally dominated her. I didn't show any sensitivity when she was distressed. I was just impatient. When decisions were to be made about our family's life, I didn't consult with her. I just made a decision and informed her what we were going to do. And that was in my formative stage as a mature human being. I've learned to correct some of those mistakes. So prayer life for me has paralleled in awareness and growth and in significant my evolution as a human being. And I hope that I'll continue to
improve in the remaining years that I have.
Tell me if this is too personal, okay? What were the times in your life that you thought God betrayed you?
Well, one of the most distressing times was in 1966. I had been a state senator 2 terms. I thought after prayer that I should run for governor of Georgia. I mounted a massive campaign all over the state, frantically, shaking hands, asking people to support me. My opponent was a racist named Lester Maddox, whose symbol was a pick handle that he used to beat African Americans over the head if they tried to come into his restaurant and buy some fried chicken. When the results came in, Lester Maddox had won, and I had lost. And I couldn't believe that the Georgia people preferred him. I couldn't believe that God would let this happen. So I had a complete renunciation of my faith. And my sister, who lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Ruth Carter Stapleton, was a very famous evangelist. My mother called her and told her that I was had this attitude. So Ruth came down to Plains, and we went out in the woods. And Ruth tried to console me, which was impossible. And Ruth quoted a couple of verses from the 2nd chapter of James, which was the foundation of Ruth's ministry, which is a very happy ministry. Anyway, James says, according to God, that no matter how horrible a mistake we made, or how total our failure might be, or how abject our despair, or how great our loss, that if we have, first of all, courage, and then if we have patience, and then if we are wise enough to seek wisdom from God, any catastrophe can be changed into a blessing. I told Ruth that this was a complete baloney. That wasn't the word I used. That it was ridiculous. And Ruth said, Jimmy, you have to have faith that this is true. She said, why don't you just forget about politics for a while and just respond to any opportunities you have. So just a few weeks later, I was asked to go as a lay witness to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, a group of volunteer Baptists from State College, which is where Penn State University is, had called every family in the phone book, and they had identified 100 families, none of whom had any religious faith. And I was asked to go and visit those families. So I knocked on the door. Some received us with open arms, some wouldn't open the door. And at the end of a week, I had experienced for the first time in my life a genuine presence of God, a sense that the Holy Spirit was with us. We had 48 people who accepted the Christian faith. We rented an old church building and left Lock Haven with a new church going. And that was a turning point in my life. I then began to see that no matter if I was elected to any future office or not, that there were other things in life. As the history books would say, I ran for governor again. I was elected. I went on and became president of the United States. But that's not the real point. The point is that when we do have a setback in politics or in business or whatever, we need to have faith that we can find an alternative that would give us much more significant priorities in life.
Jimmy Carter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
Jimmy Carter from a 1996 interview with Terry Gross. Tonight he celebrates his 75th birthday with a gala fundraiser for the Rylander Theater in Americus, Georgia. This is Fresh Air.